getting teachers vaccinated, getting food to students, and how black golfers pushed integration in Miami. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Governor DeSantis announced that teachers 50 and older can now receive the vaccine. How many will? And does this mean a full return to the classroom? Also, the pandemic has been taxing on students intellectually, emotionally, and physically. Getting food to those kids who need it most has been a challenge in the Florida Keys.
So the need has always been there, but it is a greater need, and it is something that we do discuss more, I would say, now.
And finally, race battles and protests have a long history in Miami. We'll tell you about a little-known story of just such a battle over the rights to play at a golf course decades ago. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, Governor Ron DeSantis announced the next group of people who will be eligible to receive a COVID-19 vaccine. He did it yesterday. That includes classroom teachers, law enforcement, and firefighters who are 50 years and above. The announcement came yesterday during a press conference in Hialeah. He also mentioned new pharmacies that will have the vaccine available, including select CVS and Navarro sites. Anna Fusco is the president of the Broward Teachers Union, and she joins us now. Anna, great to have you back.
Hey, how are you doing?
Great, doing fantastic. Also joining us is WLRN's healthcare reporter, Veronica Zaragovia. Veronica, always a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Veronica, let me start with you. Do we have an idea when this new group is going to be able to get the vaccine?
Luis, we don't yet know. I've put in a request for some more information from the Florida Division of Emergency Management, and they're always very speedy and helpful. So as soon as we have updates, we'll be sure to share those. When the governor makes a specific announcement like that, I'd say it's safe to assume this will be moving quickly. So it just depends on the federal sites moving, and then we'll have, you know, that new group eligible for vaccinations.
Anna, I know teachers have been fighting from the beginning to be vaccinated. First of all, what's the response that you've heard from teachers on this announcement?
Oh, I've had numerous phone calls, emails, Facebook messages, text messages that they are excited that they're being considered. You know, it's a small step because they started with the 50 and over right now. So it's a first step to getting all of our educators in our school sites and buildings throughout Broward County Public Schools and across the state of Florida.
Do you have any idea, just even a guess, as to what percentage of your teachers, basically now can get the vaccine?
Oh, I know the numbers. We between the ages of 50 and 64, and that's including our classroom teachers and everyone that's in the teacher positions and admin, principals, all of them that are on school sites. In Broward schools, there's about 7,000.
All right. Now, you know what? When the vaccine first came out, we saw healthcare workers were the first in line, but we saw that there were healthcare workers who didn't want to get it. Do you foresee a significant number of teachers who are going to say, no thanks?
Well, I have seen a small handful make those comments, but it's been a really overwhelming mass majority that they would like the vaccine, and that was really a big stepping stone for them going back onto the school sites. Even though 98% of our teachers and support staff have been back on campus, they're trying to take all the extra precautions to keep themselves COVID free, but being able to get the vaccine is just giving them that extra security and safety measures to not contract COVID.
Veronica, do we know which vaccines are going to be available to the teachers?
We don't yet know exactly whether it would be Moderna or the Pfizer vaccine, but I do want to emphasize for listeners that these are both fantastic vaccines and that no one should feel upset because, oh, they got this one or they got the other one. All of the medical experts say get whatever is offered to you, get that vaccine. And like we've been hearing on the newscast, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration is gearing to take a vote on giving the Johnson & Johnson vaccine an emergency use authorization. So that's really exciting because then within March, we'll have yet another vaccine available to Floridians.
And just a reminder, by the way, just because you get the vaccine, we still have to live with these precautions we've been living in, the social distancing and the masks. That doesn't go away, right?
Right. But I want to say that this is a great question. These vaccines are a huge deal and they are literal lifesavers. Now, so it doesn't mean that because you've got a vaccine and we're telling you to still wear a mask that they don't do anything. I mean, they will save people from dying. The problem is that not enough people have been vaccinated, so the virus is still spreading. So if you've been vaccinated, there is a chance that somebody who has no symptoms might be able to spread that virus, or you might be able to spread an asymptomatic case too. So just for a little bit longer, keep the masks on in indoor spaces or with people who haven't been vaccinated, and keep a distance. And if you have been vaccinated and someone else has been vaccinated, you can hug, you can eat together and enjoy. You know, we're getting closer to life as we knew it.
You know, the other thing too, though, just to make sure, you know, we may be repeating ourselves, but the vaccine doesn't prevent you from getting coronavirus. It just gives you a really good chance of how you respond to it.
It will, in so many cases, what it does is it eliminates extreme reactions, extreme side effects of COVID-19, which is the disease that develops from the coronavirus. And it will eliminate, it's saving people from dying from COVID-19.
Right.
So you might feel some minor symptoms if you do get a very light case, but let's just say that, I mean, experts are so optimistic and are seeing such good results that we should be trusting in these vaccines.
Anna, Broward School Superintendent Robert Runcie has said that the vaccine is not necessary to make schools safe, provided that schools are taking precautions. Do you think Broward schools are doing enough to make everyone feel safe in the classroom?
I think Broward schools and all of the educators and support staff, including school site principals and admin, are working extra above and beyond outside of their scope of their, work directions of making sure kids keep social distance, wear masks, sanitize. I mean, I walk schools every day. I see it without hesitation. They're in the halls reminding students to keep 6 feet. Mask when they're walking in the classrooms that don't have sinks. They're offering hand sanitizer to every kid. I'm watching them wipe doorknobs and rails. And so I believe because of those extra components, and because we only have about 30% of our student population back throughout the whole Broward schools. I mean, we have a small handful that might have close to 50% in our elementary levels. Those are remarkable reasons why he's standing that position that the spread is not happening. And also the contract tracing is, there's no data or information with Fidelity that it is happening with Fidelity, because it's an honor system determining if a student is COVID positive, and our employees or any outside visitors. If they don't tell the Department of Health where they work, the school district will not know. So I think those major components is what is a large rationale and reasoning of why the spread is so low. But I don't think anybody should say that you don't need the vaccine or it's unnecessary to get a vaccine when we've been in a pandemic that is so extreme and large, not just in our county, our state, our country, it's in the world. If we have every opportunity to keep people safe and healthy and they're afforded that opportunity, we should be encouraging it and making, every conversation out there possible to make people feel safe and secure. I want to say that our schools are definitely safe and kept great, but it's because of the rank and file that are in those school sites every day. Again, working outside their scope of teaching and planning, making sure everything is healthy and clean. Our custodians are doing great, but without the help of everybody, I don't think it would be to the level that it is.
And I'm wondering, Anna, how many teachers or staff, and how many folks have already gotten the vaccine, because maybe they met the requirements. I wonder if you heard from them and what they told you. How do they feel right now?
I've heard from a lot. you know, I've heard from a lot, especially when we were able to open up the Markham Park site for our 65 and over educators, employees of Broward County. And, you know, so many went and they feel so much safer and they feel a lot more at ease. They're still taking all of these precautions that you've just mentioned and not let the guard down.
Yeah.
But, and that is a big position that people said that if I have the vaccine, I will be able to walk back on my campus because so many have taken. Retired.
You know what? You had to retire. You have people who are retiring. But the other thing, too, is this, because as we've been reporting, is you have teachers who quit. They just said, nope, I can't do this. I'm not going to do this. And I'm wondering how many of them have kind of walked back from that because maybe now they see a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel.
Well, some of them, unfortunately, if they retired or quit with the retirement, they can't walk back.
No, I'm talking about just teachers who are like, I quit. They've left the profession because they just feel like they can't get back to the classroom.
Well, that did happen. Now, affording to get the vaccine and they can try to come back, I'm sure that might be a possibility, but I haven't really had fruitful conversations with that group of individuals.
Oh, okay. I know we've talked about that before, and I just want to see how the state of mind of teachers right now and get a sense. Again, we're talking about the announcement from yesterday that teachers, and that's just one of a number of groups, are now will soon be able to get their vaccines if you're 50 and older. That announcement made yesterday. I'm talking with WLRN's healthcare reporter, Veronica Zaragovia, and the president of the Broward Teachers Union, Anna Fusco. And I just want to mention again, too, that if maybe you're a teacher, you can always share your thoughts with us. Just find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. We'd love to hear your thoughts about this announcement and how that makes you feel. Veronica, the governor also announced new vaccine sites yesterday, and that you'd be able to get it in other places like some CVSs. What else did he say?
That's right. There'll be about 30 Navarro discount pharmacies in Miami-Dade County, another 30, 35 CVS IMAS, and then there'll be one CVS traditional store, and then in Miami-Dade. And then Broward and Palm Beach will have a few traditional CVS stores offering the vaccines as well. We have Jackson Health System has now added people 55 and older who have 13 specific underlying conditions. Those include congestive heart failure, leukemia, sickle cell disease, lung and breast cancer. We have that full list at WLRN.org, and you'd need to have a doctor's note to prove that you have one of these underlying conditions. So we have new possibilities. And then Palm Beach County announced yesterday that they have a new site as well, and we have that information on our site. So we do have more options.
And, law enforcement now added to that group with teachers, 50 and older, can get their vaccine. Is there going to be a special place for them to get their vaccine, or it's just wherever it's available? Like teachers, can they go to a specific place?
Right. So the teachers and law enforcement and the police officers, and then any firefighters who have not yet been vaccinated, who are 50 years old and older, can go to a site at Miami-Dade College North Campus. That's a partnership with the federal government. So basically the state will be running like appointments and all of that, but the vaccines will be supplied by the vaccine count is a federal government count that's in addition to what the state gets on a regular basis. And so that will be opening up on March 3rd from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., 7 days a week. So we'll have a site open every day. And they're also going to have mobile units going out to underserved communities. And so that will increase vaccinations.
Anna, are you hearing from parents? I'm wondering, with this new rollout, are they getting a little more comfortable? Or, I don't know. What are you hearing from them?
Yeah, I've heard from some parents that, the teachers get vaccinated, that'll make them feel more comfortable sending their children in. They're concerned of their children contracting it, and maybe not that their child might get so severely sick, but the possibility of bringing it home to the family, if somebody has, one of these serious illnesses that can cause some real, harm. So I know the parents, love and support their child's teacher, and they want to make sure that their teachers and support staff are healthy and safe. And then if anything that can make it safer for their children to come back on campus, they're also in favor of it.
Yeah. Veronica, I want to mention, by the way, that you're hosting a Facebook Live event tonight. You're going to be answering people's questions about vaccines and access. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yes, and hopefully Anna can also share with her network. We will be having an event. I want to make sure that people have access to physicians to ask any questions, and what this is open for everybody, but we're especially wanting our Black neighbors to log on and ask questions and be able to get any answers that they need in order to know more about the vaccines and make sure that they feel confident in the safety. We will also have Pastor Richard Dunn with us and from Miami, and he will help talk about the role that Black churches are playing in vaccinating people. We have partnerships in the state all the time. Tomorrow, Jackson is having one. Yeah. We will have information on our website, our Twitter account. Email us.
It'll be everywhere. We'll make sure to post it up there. Again, WLRN's healthcare reporter, Veronica Zaragovia. And also I want to thank President of the Broward Teachers Union, Anna Fusco. Anna, Veronica, thank you so much for the insight.
Thank you so much.
And remember, tonight's Facebook Live panel discussion with health experts will be hosted by Veronica. They will be answering your questions about COVID-19 and vaccinations. It starts at 6 p.m. on the WLRN Sundial Facebook page. You can also submit your questions via social media or email news@WLRNnews.org. Again, just stay up with our social media to keep updated on that. Well, still to come, Florida Keys educators are facing a challenge. Make sure their kids have something to eat. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. There are thousands of students in South Florida who are struggling to learn in this pandemic world. Many are still learning at home, and we've learned that thousands have dropped out. Another challenge for educators is feeding students in need. We now bring in Nan Klinger from the studios of Key West to look at one of the stories in the series, The Class of COVID. A one-hour documentary special on Class of COVID will air tonight on WLRN-TV. At 6 p.m. tonight. And you can find all the stories at classofcovid.org. Nan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Lewis.
First, give us a picture of what the schools look like in Monroe County. Are all students back in a classroom, or like many districts, it's a mix?
It's a mix. Students from pre-K through fifth grade are back in the classroom every day. And then most of the kids from 6th through 12th grades are on what they call an A-B schedule. So you go Monday, Wednesday, Friday 1 week, and then Tuesday, Thursday, basically every other day, every other school day, you come to class. And the days that you're not in class, you're doing distance learning at home. Some kids in those higher grades are coming to class every day because they need a little more help to get their work done, but most of them are on that A-B schedule.
So for the Class of COVID project, you looked at one of the challenges for some of the students in Monroe County, food insecurity. Before the pandemic, do we know how many students were considered eligible for free or reduced lunches?
We do. It was just over half the students. There were about 9,000 kids in the school system at that time, and about 4,600 of them were on the free and reduced lunch program.
And when we talk about Monroe, I mean, we're talking about the Keys, right?
Right.
Okay. So, you know, give me an idea, like what parts of the Keys usually do you see really the greater challenges?
You know, it is really throughout the Keys. All the islands and communities have their own characters and personalities, but there are 5 Title I schools, which means they have an especially high number of kids getting free and reduced lunch and other federal benefits. And those schools are throughout the Keys from Key Largo down to Key West.
Yeah. And by the way, during the regular year, like before the pandemic, kids were getting some food from the schools already, right?
Well, they were getting that free and reduced lunch.
Sure. Okay, yeah. That's right. Okay. Now, you spoke with Denise Santiago. She's the principal at Horace O'Brien School, right?
That's correct.
What did she tell you about the needs of her students?
She said it wasn't a new thing that there was a need for making sure that kids had enough food, but that the need had definitely increased because of the pandemic, but that also their ability to address it had also increased, and any stigma that might be around having free and reduced lunches or extra meals had also decreased. Because, you know, the USDA is now basically paying for that for everybody. So there isn't like a, you have to specially sign up or be singled out or any of that stuff.
And by the chance, if you didn't get to hear the story, by the way, I mean, it is online, but let's hear a little bit of a cut from Denise Santiago.
It truly is not something new. It is something that I feel like has always been a challenge for us, having been at the same school, the same, you know, clientele of children that come to our school. So the need has always been there, but it is a greater need. And it is something that we do discuss more, I would say, now.
You know, something interesting is that what you pointed out in the story is something about older kids. And I was thinking about this in my experience covering this story for years and years and years now. You get the older kids and there's this pride that kind of kicks in. And they're less likely to ask for help, right?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, who wants to acknowledge that, you know, any kind of peer pressure?
And with parents, do you also get that sense? Or parents, or do parents speak up? I don't know. Are they speaking about what the needs are?
I think some are. But again, there is that something of a stigma. The principal up at the Key Largo school, Laura Leotard, told me that when they had done some programs like this before the pandemic and they'd sent home permission slips, you know, for people to sign up where they have to do an explicit act to say, yes, we need help. They didn't get as much response as they expected. Now what the schools are doing is they just set up carts with bags of food. Mm. And when school lets out, the kids just grab a bag on their way to the bus or to the school, you know, the parent waiting to pick them up out front.
And how are they getting into the kids who are not coming to school?
Well, every kid is supposed to be coming to school every other day at the very least. So they prepare extra bags for weekends and holidays.
Okay. Again, talking with WLRN's Monroe County reporter Nan Klingen of the Florida Keys. A paradise to a lot of us has been struggling through this pandemic, like a lot of places, especially the schools. You can read more of her reporting in the Class of COVID series at theclassofcovid.org. Again, a one-hour special on WLRN TV airs tonight. There is that perception, Ann, that, you know, life is so laid back and easy in the Keys, but obviously, as you pointed out, that's not the case for everybody. What other assistance do a lot of these kids usually need or from where they're coming from?
Yeah, I mean, it's everything from clothes, you know. Early in the pandemic, some of the Rotary clubs got involved and made sure that there were enough hot spots when all the kids were home. You know, after spring break last year, suddenly everybody needed to have internet access, which not everybody does. So the school was able to make sure every kid had a laptop, a Chromebook, but not every kid had Wi-Fi access. So some of our local foundations and Rotary clubs made sure that there were enough hotspots available for that kind of thing.
We saw that, or we see now that counties, there's some counties, the school districts, they're going to lose money because enrollment is down. Students just aren't showing up. Some have gone on to work, but I'm just wondering, what have you seen in Monroe County? They're probably going to lose some money, too.
That's right. Our enrollment is down about 2.8%, and they are expecting about a 3% budget cut that they say they're going to have to implement across the board.
Have educators figured out where did those students go? What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, some of them probably left the Keys, and there are very few of those in Monroe County. We're fortunate that we're a relatively small district, so there's only 7 that they haven't accounted for, is what the superintendent said on the Sunshine Economy earlier this week. So that's fortunate that way.
Have you seen any stories like we have up here of students just not going back, maybe even some going to work?
What I have heard is that some of the students, the older kids who are on that AB schedule, have started working on that day that they're not going to campus. And the superintendent's very concerned about that because she wants them to be able to come back full time to campus when it's deemed safe to do so.
Hmm. Again, looking at this need in Monroe County, it's in a lot of places, but kids, you know, some kids in need and getting food to them in a time like this, in this pandemic. You can check out the story, Nan's story, on our website, WLRN.org. It is part of the Classic COVID series. Nan, is always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Great to talk to you, Lewis.
All right, again, WLRN's Monroe County reporter Nan Klinginer. And again, that special airs tonight. It's a one-hour special on WLRN TV. Go to our social media, WLRN Sundial, to get the latest update. Now, I want to tell you about something new that we have here. It's the Sundial Text Club. And here's how it works. You send us your thoughts, your comments, your questions, and someone, it may be me, we'll get back to you. And we'll give you updates on the show, but we'll also be able to, you know, talk to you about possibly taking part in future programs. Here's how you join. Just text the word hello to 786-677-0767. Again, that's hello to 786-677-0767. All right, still to come, we've got a story about a group of black golfers from the 40s who stood up against the county and white elites. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the world watched yesterday as news emerged of Tiger Woods surviving a perilous car crash. Woods sustained significant injuries to his right leg in the accident. Although he's been shrouded in controversy in recent years for his actions off the course, Woods is unquestionably one of the greatest golfers of all time, and he paved the way for a generation of black golfers in the sport. However, there were generations of black golfers in the U.S. way before Woods, and some were here in Miami. They were part of a long battle over racial integration. The book, The Miami Times and the Fight for Equality, explores the fight to integrate a white-only golf course in a predominantly black neighborhood during the 40s and 50s. The fight was led by the black-run newspaper, The Miami Times, which remains in publication today. Janila McLeod is the author and a professor at Florida Agricultural and Mechanical University. She'll be speaking tomorrow on a panel with Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava about the history of racism in the county, and she joins us now. Janila, welcome to the program. It's really a pleasure.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
You know, Miami has this long history of civil rights protests and activism. There was the iconic meeting between Malcolm X, Sam Cooke, Jim Brown, and Muhammad Ali. And that was told in the story one night here in Miami. There was the McDuffie Rebellion in the 1980s. But how did you come across this story of the Miami Times and the protest to integrate golf courses in the 40s and 50s?
Well, I have long been a reporter for a black newspaper in Tallahassee, Florida, called the Capital Outlook newspaper. And when I left the newspaper to go to graduate school, I decided to make the black press my focus of research study. And in that, I started specifically looking at black newspapers in Florida. And Miami Times was one of the oldest, long-sustaining ones. And as I was doing my research on the Miami Times, this golf case called the Rice versus Arnold case kept popping up. And so the research just kind of led me there. And as a student at the time, you know, you have to pick a focus. And it just, a light bulb came on and said, not many people know about this story. And it would be a wonderful one that's representative of the impact and the role of the black newspaper in civil rights.
And was there, like, in as these stories kept popping up, was there a moment, one particular story or something you read that lit that light bulb up and you said, oh yeah, this is it, I gotta talk about this?
Yes, it's one, I was just trying to, because the black newspaper has been on the front lines, or the black press has been on the front lines since its inception in 1827 with Freedom's Journal, fighting for the cause of civil rights and equality. There's so much to explore because the history of black people, it's in those newspapers. And so I had to keep trying to whittle it down. And I was talking to a friend of mine. I was like, what am I going to do? What am I going to focus on? And I was in the library one day, and for whatever reason, it just kind of stood out. That same golf course case popped up, and I said, by God, this is it. That's the story that I'm going to tell, because it's just really representative of everything I wanted to express about the impact of the black newspaper.
You know, like a lot of writers say, sometimes the story finds you.
Exactly.
Let's set the stage. Florida's migration boom began en masse following World War II, but how is the state attracting Northerners and Midwesterners by the thousands to the Sunshine State at that time?
Yeah, really, in the early 1800s, we're going to have the railroad boom, Henry Flagler, and others are building railroads that are connecting all the way down south to Miami. And Florida had long established itself as the tourism capital of the world. So people from Europe would come here during their cold winters, the same as those from the north. And so this was the place to be as it related to tourism. And so that's how people are coming here. And although Florida is going to, paint itself as the leisure capital of the world, it's a very different experience for not only Black people who lived in Florida and in the South in Miami, but those who wanted to travel to the state as a part of a vacation. Segregation is the law of the land. And so the experience is going to be very different for Black people as it relates to the state of Florida.
Yeah. And South Florida was unique in the sense that, the population here, what you had when it came to the Black community, which includes African Americans, but also Black Caribbean communities. How large that community was, that Black community was here in South Florida, around that era, again, post-World War II?
Yes, about 1/4 of the Black population in Miami at the time were from the Caribbean, different areas in the Caribbean, particularly the Bahamas and Jamaica. And the person who's going to establish the Miami Times newspaper is H.E. Reeves, and he migrates to this country from the Bahamas. And, people are coming here. They see the industry. They see the economic potential. It's also the land is nutrient rich for growing crops and agricultural, something that is native to the Bahamian culture. And so a lot of people from the Caribbean will make their home in Miami.
And of course, not just rich for agriculture, rich also for golf. And it still is to this day. Golf was very popular, back then in that era in America, because again, Florida, it just had the great temperatures to be able to play golf in the wintertime. But there were courses, obviously, that were built. And this is what you start to point out. There were courses that were built near or in majority Black communities like Miami Springs. But I'm wondering, what was the response when you build a course in or near a Black community, but then you have signs that say, oh, sorry, whites only?
So segregation, that's the federal law of the land at the time. And what's interesting is golf is really the sport for the white elite. And so even poor whites didn't really have access to golf courses at the time. The issue with the Miami Springs golf course is this was a public golf course. It's not a private golf course. And so Black people felt like if we pay taxes, we should have access to that golf course just like everyone else. And the way that kind of stung at the dignity and the humanity of Black people is the Miami Golf Springs, the course would say that Black people could play on the course, but only one day a week. And they relegated it to Monday, which was the day that was set aside to maintain the course, cut the grass, water the grass, those types of things. So it was just really an affront to their human dignity and their respect. And so this is a symbol of segregation that Black people are going to look at to say, if we tear that down, that's going to express our demand for equal rights in this country.
Was there a person or maybe a group of people who were the most vocal in this fight?
Yes. So what happens is you had at the time the Miami Negro Golf Association. It's later going to be called the Cosmopolitan Golf Association. And they are going to unify and challenge the one day a week rule. And this is a group of business men and women in Miami, because during that time, Overtown and some of the other areas, these were thriving Black communities that had lucrative Black businesses. And so these were among the Black elite who would play golf and make business deals. And so they're going to use this as a platform for civil rights. And so that Miami Golf Association, the Cosmopolitan Golf Association, one of its players, Joseph Rice will be the plaintiff for the golf case to say that it's they need to integrate that course.
Yeah. So you have a group of black golfers who want to have access. They believe, well, that's a public course. I pay taxes. Let me get on. And of course, you know, the pressure by the white elite is saying, no. Where did the fight go then? And how long did that fight take?
So this fight is going to begin in 1948, and it's going to take 10 years. And Thurgood Marshall will even come to Florida, to Miami, to advise the golfers on their efforts to integrate the course. What's important here is about the Miami Times. And the Miami Times is the newspaper of the day, the black newspaper of the day. And its managing editor, Garth Reeves, was a member of the Golf Association. And so strategically, they are behind the scenes launching this lawsuit and trying to figure out the best way to tear down segregation in all aspects of public life in Florida, and particularly in Miami, the beaches, the schools. And so this is just one example. And the newspaper decides to be used as the communication organ for this fight, or the tool for this fight. And so because it lends its pages as a voice of protest, also for information and unification, it will get the attention that it needs for people to rally behind this golf case. And the case is going to eventually make it to the U.S. Supreme Court, who will encourage Florida, because it gets to the state court and Florida is going to uphold segregation. The U.S. Supreme Court is going to tell them to reconsider it. And that's going to open the door for integration, for the golf course to be desegregated.
You know, something interesting you said a moment ago, it's like golf has always been seen, obviously, as an elitist sport, because even not all whites can play. It's not cheap. It's, you know, it's a very expensive sport. And usually it's always been left to just a small group of people within that black community, though. Was there enough exposure to golf for these black golfers? Not again, given the restrictions. I mean, did you have, I guess, members of a black elite golf group?
Yes. And even beyond the elite, we have to remember that with golf came caddies, and the black people were the caddies for the golf. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so they are exposed and engaged with golf for a century when golf starts. And so the caddies, of course, ingenuity, they wait until, you know, it's nighttime or the dusk, and they go out and they play. And so black golf associations will be established throughout the country and also in the South, not just in the North. And a lot of the leading golfers like John Shippen and George Franklin Grant, who invented the golf tee, and Dewey Brown and John Bartholomew and Lee Elder, many of them will start as caddies, and they create their own leagues, their own golf associations, where they can play as amateurs or professionals in their league. And so you have golf is a part of black history since its existence, since it began in this country.
Again, I'm talking with Janila McLeod. She's one of the speakers in a panel conversation tomorrow with Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava, examining Miami-Dade's history of racism. And we're discussing McLeod's book, The Miami Times and Fight for Equality. You can find more information on our social media, WLRN Sundial. This very interesting story about a golf course and fight for equality over a golf course back in the 1940s and 50s. You know, we spoke with Reeves' grandson, Garth Reeves III, who is the paper's publisher today, and he explained how the history of the paper continues to be fundamental to their mission. Here's what he said.
He was truly a businessman. He was committed to every aspect of the Miami Times. He opened up the shop every single day. You know, right up to his death, he was trying to stay involved with the operation of the paper, which is something that seems to be true of all Reeves's. We can't seem to, you know, detach ourselves, even in retirement, from the Miami Times.
What were the principles of the paper when it was founded?
I mean, you know, a strong commitment to local journalism, being the voice of our community, telling our story and, you know, getting it right. Our core principles are, you know, really do remain the same, whereas a lot of other factors have changed over time. How we deliver news to our readers has changed, but, you know, our commitment remains the same. We still put a lot of effort into producing a paper each week.
So, Janila, how was the Miami Times seen outside of its readership? Was it a respectable paper for politicians and institutions? I mean, how was it capable of shaking things up?
Garth Reeves, and I had the pleasure of Garth Reeves accepting me as one of his friends. He died at age 100, so it was a beautiful friendship. But Garth Reeves' father, Henry Reeves, as well as Garth Reeves, these are people who were civic-minded, and they sat on boards of hospitals and banks. Garth Reeves will be a part of the state's first integrated bank. And so these were people who had influence, and where they had their influence, they used their voice to prick the consciousness of whites who were in power. And so they were there to not only advocate, but also to try and get people to understand the different cultures in order to improve race relations. And so when you're talking about being on boards of the Children's Hospital, being a part of the Red Cross, all of these things that met the needs of the community, not just the Black community, but Miami's community. And these were men and women of integrity. And what they wrote in those newspapers, they could stand on because it was the truth. And at the end of the day, when the truth is presented before you, it's up to you to either accept it or to make the conscious decision to oppose it. And so the Reeves, that family continues to be one that is a legacy of honesty, truth, integrity, and advocacy.
And do you see it having the same role that it did, especially in those earlier years?
So I'm grateful that Garth B. Reeves took on the platform of continuing the newspaper. Fortunately, we don't have to fight the same kinds of fights that our mother and our grandfathers had to fight. And so while the signs are down, the issues and the conditions are still the same. The value of it, of the newspaper now, if they stay on top of their game, is where things were overt before, whites only, Blacks only. Now things are under the radar. And what we see is we have to be proactive in telling the story, in keeping these conditions out front, because if we don't, people will not recognize the systematic issues or the systems that are continuing to oppress people today, because things look like we have made such advancements that those are ways of the past, but really the vestiges of those systems continue to negatively impact populations. And that's where I see the Miami Times stepping up to say, in this new time, in this new realm, using new technologies and social media, they are going to remain a public voice as an outlet for the Black community.
So you think about it, we bring it all the way back to this era today, and we see, you know, what's happening. I mean, you think about the fights in your story that you bring up, this fight that a group of Black golfers bring all the way to this U.S. Supreme Court just for, you know, the opportunity to play golf. And now you see athletes, Black athletes, and over the last few years, it's been a very different message, but still relatively same. This one, in this case, it's about social justice around police brutality and the Black Lives Matter movement jumping in. But you see athletes from baseball and basketball, football, I mean, all the way through, even hockey and soccer have gotten involved in some way. Do you think that, you know, what you see from these athletes today compared to what we saw in that fight with the golfers, that what they're doing today is just lip service, or are they really changing the narrative, the changing the culture?
Well, see, athletic activism has also been a part of African-American history. And so these young men and women today are just following in that legacy and that foundation that was established. If we look at Black history, some of the leading voices for calling for social change, and today we call it social justice, it's still civil rights, it's a civil rights movement. These leading voices were Black men and women who were athletes. Many of them were athletes. When we talk about Muhammad Ali and Althea Gibson and Jesse Owens, and when we have Tommy Smith and Carlos holding the Black Power fist during the Olympics in Mexico City, athletic activism has been a way to help tear down racial barriers for centuries. And because they have the platform and they have the voice and they had the courage, it has been an effective platform. What I see today, which is kind of a gem that's coming out of that legacy, is today, the young men and women have realized, these athletes realize they own their own brand. They own their athleticism. And so they can make the decision whether to walk off of a team or not, or whether to play, and that will economically impact these leagues. And so I think that it is not lip service. And what I think is the greater good is they are doing it collectively. When we first saw Colin Kaepernick out there on his own, just simply kneeling as a symbol of calling attention to the issue of police shootings of unarmed Black men and women. He was out there on his own. But as you start to see people supporting him and you see these athletes coming together as a collective, their power is intensifying and it's having a larger impact and forcing the hand of the owners and the leaders of these leagues.
Yeah. Let's go back to this fight. So it goes all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. So how did it turn out?
So in 1958, the state of Florida is going to rule that segregation is on this golf course is illegal. And that will open the doors for desegregation on public golf courses in Fort Lauderdale, Jacksonville, and all across Tampa, Orlando, all across the state. And this was not an easy fight. It was something that had been, the plaintiffs had changed, because fighting for social justice is exhausting. But what you have to do is have to have the tenacity and the courage to not give up. And so we see that again as just one symbol of the efforts for an equal democracy in the state of Florida and down in Miami. And so that's gonna open the doors. It's gonna happen. It's gonna become desegregated at the same time that the public bus systems are going to be ruled desegregated. And so this is a very positive time. It's an optimistic time and a time of hope. And we can really see the shift in history happening at that moment.
And it was, a time of hope, but at the same time, as you said, it's a long, hard battle, because now these courses are open doesn't mean that it was just that easy.
Absolutely. And we know the Civil War is going to end in 1865. And we go through a period of reconstruction for about 10 years, and Black people make tremendous gains. They get elected to the US House, US Senate. They hold positions in the state legislature, those types of things. Reconstruction will come to an end. And from the end of Reconstruction, in about 1877, 1878, remember, Black people get the right to vote and all the rights after the Civil War. It's from 1877 all the way until 1965 that Black people were fighting for voting rights and for civil rights. And those laws don't pass until the end of 1965. And so the legacy of the institutional racism that kept people at the margins and kept segregation as the rule of the law, the legacy, the impact is sustaining and even today. And COVID is something that illuminates this to the rest of the world. But the people who are living it and experience it know it. So this is a continuing fight. And until our country really makes the institutional changes it needs that will not allow the discrimination and the oppression and the segregation, economic segregation, we're going to continue to see that fight. But I see today the young people are saying no more. And there are people of goodwill and good conscience in positions of power of all different races and ethnicities and genders who are also at the table saying, no more, it's time for us to change. And I feel really optimistic and hopeful about it.
This is such a fascinating story because, again, it's about this golf course. And it's not a story you think about, you know, it's not one of those stories because you think about, again, as I mentioned before, you know, the famous night when Muhammad Ali was here with Malcolm X and Sam Cooke and all that, but, you know, still an important part of the story, a thread in the story. Just real briefly though, golf still seems like a very elite, very white sport, even with Tiger Woods, didn't really change that much. Still not very colorful, still really very white.
Well, I mean, one person will open the door and then you will see, you know, as you see later on, change takes time. And Tiger Woods is walking through a door that Lee Elder opened and John Shippen opened.
Yeah.
And I think when you saw Tiger Woods play, what the difference you saw was if you looked on the sidelines and saw the crowds of people who were rooting for him over the course of his career, it was very diverse, not only racially, but ethnically and gender and ages. And so you could see his impact there. And so I, you know, it's going to take time before you start to see some, you know, things change as it relates to the culture of some of these games.
Yeah.
But the door is open. And once that ceiling is cracked, it's not going to be, it's not going to crack.
No. And as a fan, I'm just saying, you know, I thought it, when I first saw him come, I thought this is exciting. We'll see, you know, a more diversity in the sport. I think we saw it when the Williams sisters showed up to tennis. We really did see an expansion of diversity, and you see that the women who win today compared to golf, maybe golf is a little bit slower to it, but hopefully, as you said, that door is open and so more people will come through. I want to thank you again, Janila McLeod. She's one of the speakers at a panel conversation tomorrow talking about Miami-Dade history and racism. Again, her book, The Miami Times and a Fight for Equality. Check out our social media, WLN Sundial, to learn more about it. Janila, thanks so much. I love this story.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Definitely. Have a wonderful day. Well, that's our program for this Wednesday, February 24th. Coming up tomorrow on the program, no one wants to think about the sewage that leaves their home, but the infrastructure that moves that sewage that cleans it is crumbling in South Florida. We're going to take a look at this incredible story from reporters Katie Switalski-Munoz and Jenny Stiletovich. All of that coming up tomorrow on the program. By the way, we'll mention our book club book tomorrow on the show. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks for listening. Talk to you tomorrow.